72. Civic Temples. Reuben felt weak in his legs and sat down, resting his chest against the edge of the table. However vehemently he had contradicted Sir Logdin, listening to him had been all the more painful because there was a grain of truth in what he had said. Yes, some of those in the communist youth movement were not worth the cardboard used to make their membership cards. Yes, the foundations of morality had been sapped, and people, especially the younger generation, were losing their feel for what was right and noble. Societies, like fish, go rotten from the head. Who was there to set an example for the young? In older societies, people knew that a moral code needs safeguards, a church and a priest with authority. What Polish woman, even now, takes any serious step in life without consulting her parish priest? As things were, the preservation of moral standards was perhaps much more important to the land of the Soviets than the Volga Don Canal or the Angara hydroelectric station. What could be done about it? His proposal for the establishment of civic places of worship, already completed in first draft, was Rubin's contribution. He must use this sleepless night to finalize it and try to smuggle it out with his next visitor. Once outside, it would be typed and submitted to the Central Committee. He could not send it under his own name. The Central Committee would reject advice of this sort from a political prisoner. Nor could it be sent anonymously. One of his old army friends would have to sign it. Reuben would gladly sacrifice authorial fame in a good cause. Fighting down the waves of pain in his head, out of habit he packed his pipe with golden fleece, though he had no wish to smoke right then, indeed felt an aversion to it, took a puff and began looking through his project. Wearing an overcoat over his underwear, sitting at a bare, roughly plain table littered with crumbs and tobacco, breathing the stale air of the unswept corridor along which sleepy zecs hurried from time to time on their nocturnal errands, the anonymous author examined the disinterested project that he had roughed out in his hasty scrawl on several sheets of paper. The preamble spoke of the need to raise the moral level of the population, high though it already was, and to enhance the significance of anniversaries and family occasions by introducing solemn ceremonies. For this purpose, civic temples should be established everywhere, each of them a majestic building dominating its locality. The organizational details were set out in several sections, each broken up into paragraphs, so as not to overtax the brains of authority. Civic temples should be built in centers of population of a certain size, in order to serve a particular territorial unit. The dates to be commemorated should be specified for each of them, likewise the duration of the ceremonies. Young people, as they came of age, should attend in groups and, in the presence of a great concourse, take a special oath of loyalty to the party, their fatherland, and their parents. The project was particularly insistent that temple servants should wear special garments symbolizing their snow-white purity, that the ritual form of words should be rhythmically phrased, that no means of having an impact on the sense organs of those who visited the temples should be overlooked. A special fragrance in the air, melodious music and singing, colored glass and floodlights, murals by skilled artists, and the architectural design of the temple as a whole should serve to develop the aesthetic taste of the population. Every word of the project had to be selected with painstaking discrimination from an array of synonyms. Otherwise, unperceptive and superficial people might conclude from a carelessly used word that the author was simply proposing to revive Christian temples without Christ. But this was profoundly untrue. Someone who liked to draw historical analogies might also accuse the author of copying Robespierre's Cult of the Supreme Being. But of course that, too, was not the same thing at all. Not at all. The author considered the most original part of the project to be the section on the new, no, not priests, but temple attendants, as he called them. He considered that the key to the success of the whole project lay in establishing throughout the nation a core of authoritative attendants who enjoyed the love and trust of the people because of their own irreproachable and selfless way of life. The party authorities were to select candidates for training as temple attendants, transferring them from their present employment, whatever it might be. Once the initial acute shortage was overcome, training courses would get longer and more thorough year by year, giving the attendants a broad general education with special emphasis on elocution. The project daringly asserted that the art of public speaking had declined in the Soviet Union, possibly because no one was in need of persuasion, since the whole population unconditionally supported its very own state. Meanwhile, Rubin was not in the least surprised that nobody came to look at a sick prisoner who had chosen the wrong time to die. He had seen the same thing only too often in counter-espionage units and transit prisons. So when the key grated in the lock, his instinctive reaction was one of terror. He had been caught at dead of night doing something he shouldn't be doing, and the consequence would be some excruciatingly tedious punishment. He swept up his papers, his book, his tobacco, and would have fled to his room, but he was too late. The stocky, plug-ugly sergeant major had spotted him and was calling to him from the open door. His mind cleared, and he was painfully aware again that he was alone, abandoned, insulted, humiliated. "Sergeant Major," he said, walking slowly toward the duty officer's deputy. "I've been trying to get the medical assistant for more than 2 hours now. I will make a complaint about the medical assistant and about you to the prison administration of the Ministry of State Security." The sergeant major was conciliatory. "I couldn't get here any sooner, Rubin. There was nothing I could do about it. Let's go." In fact, all he could do when he learned that a prisoner, one of the most noxious prisoners at that, was making a disturbance, was to knock on the lieutenant's door. There was no answer for some time. Then the female medical assistant looked out and disappeared again. In the end, the lieutenant emerged looking disgruntled and gave the sergeant major permission to bring Rubin along. Rubin put his arms into the sleeves of his coat and buttoned it to conceal his underwear. The sergeant major took him along the basement hallway of the Sharashka, and they went up into the prison yard by a flight of wooden steps, on which a thick covering of snow had settled. In the picturesquely quiet night, with white flakes falling copiously, dim and dark places as far as the horizon seemed to be punctuated by a multitude of slender white columns. Rubin and the sergeant major crossed the yard, leaving deep tracks in the fluffy snow. Under this pleasant, overcast sky, which the lights of the sleeping city made smoky brown, feeling the touch of the cool hexahedral flakes like the fingers of innocent children on his uplifted head and feverish face, Rubin stood stock still and closed his eyes. A blissful calm filled his whole being, all the sweeter for being so brief. From this he could draw the strength to live. This was happiness. To go nowhere, ask for nothing, want nothing, to stand there the whole night through, blissfully, blessedly, as trees stand, catching the snowflakes on his upturned face. At that very moment, from the railway line, less than a kilometre away from Marfino, came a long, warbling hoot, the strangely moving, lonely cry of a train that reminds us in ripe years of childhood, because in our childhood it promised us so much for our prime. If only he could stand there just half an hour, he would be himself again, in body and spirit, and he would compose a moving little poem about train whistles in the night. If only he didn't have to follow his escort. But his escort was already looking back suspiciously, wondering whether Rubin had thoughts of escaping into the night. Rubin's legs went where they were meant to go. The medical assistant was rosy from the sleep of youth, and a flush played on her cheeks. She had white overalls on, but was obviously not wearing tunic and shirt or anything much underneath. Most prisoners would have taken note of this, and so at any other time would Rubin, but in his present frame of mind he could not demean himself by thinking of this vulgar creature who had made him suffer torments all night. "Please give me a triple dose, and something to help me sleep, only not luminal. I want to get off right away." "We've got nothing for insomnia," she answered automatically.
"Please do what I ask," Rubin insisted. "I've got a job to do for the minister first thing in the morning, and I can't get to sleep."
This mention of the minister, together with the likelihood that Rubin would go on standing there stubbornly begging for his powder, as well as her expectation from certain indications that the lieutenant would shortly rejoin her, made the medical assistant depart from her usual practice and provide medicine. She got powders from a cabinet and made Reuben take the lot with water. In prison regulations, a powder is regarded as a weapon and must be put into a prisoner's mouth, never into his hands. Reuben asked what the time was and learned that it was 3:30. As he walked back across the yard and looked back at the limes lit up by reflected light from the 500 and 200 watt lamps in the campgrounds, he took deep breaths of snow-scented air, bent down to grab handfuls of sparkling, fluffy snow, and rubbed his face, rubbed his neck, filled his mouth with the weightless, incorporeal, ice-cold stuff. His soul was in communion with the freshness of the world.